The following podcast was recorded at the 2012 COTBC Pre-AGM Workshop, Social Media and Occupational Therapy Practice. The recording begins with a welcome from Jeff Boniface, Chair of the COTBC Client Relations Committee.
Welcome, everyone. Happy Occupational Therapy Month. Tell me, let's just raise hands. Has everyone put a bumper sticker on their car? Has anyone seen the billboards out there? Thanks so much, COT, for doing that, and later on we'll be hearing from them. But everyone, make sure you're joining COTBC. I'm here this morning on behalf of the college. It's my pleasure to introduce the pre-AGM workshop and our keynote speaker. This workshop is an outcome of last year's session on professional boundaries. It was identified that social media was being used widely and some guidance may be needed to prevent boundary violations. At the same time, we know that there's some excellent uses of social media that our clients and colleagues are wanting to incorporate into OT practice. Today, we hope to learn more about this new way of communicating. Barb Wilson is our keynote speaker today and is a practice consultant with the College of Registered Nurses of BC. She has a special interest in ethical and legal issues for registered nurses and nurse practitioners and how these issues relate to the use of social media. She provides education and consultation services to nurses and others across the province on social media, including nurses who were reported to the college for misuse of social media. Barb has worked as a registered nurse for almost 30 years, working primarily with children and youth. She has a master's in nursing from the University of British Columbia, and prior to working for the Nurses College, she was the co-director of the Cardiac Sciences Program at BC Children's. Although Barb feels that she's not an expert in the use of social media, she has seen it used widely and wisely and unwisely. We look forward to her sharing these experiences and helping us to frame the ways we can responsibly use social media in occupational therapy practice. Please, everyone, help join me in welcoming our guest today, Barb Wilson. Thanks so much.
I'm very pleased to be here. What a wonderful group. It's so nice to see everybody, and I'm sure for you all to get reconnected. It's such an interesting topic. Where are you at with social media and OT practice? What does it even mean to say WHRRU? This is the things that we have to consider now as healthcare professionals, some of this language. So I understand from last year, from your pre-AGM workshop, that you had a session on boundaries, and I know that some of you may have been there. And this is such a natural kind of segue into this topic of social media, because there are many, obviously, professional ethical issues that we need to consider as professionals when dealing with social media. So if you have questions about social media, you are absolutely not alone. At the college, for sure at the College of Registered Nurses, we get many, many, many questions from nurses about how to use social media, what are the appropriate guidelines, so to speak. And what I have to say today is that the actual professional rules, norms, etiquette related to some of the use of these tools is actually not well established. We're starting to establish it, but there's a lot of gray. So I'm really looking forward to some rich discussion today. I'm going to do a little bit of a presentation in a little later, and then Lauren's going to join us and work you through a case scenario. So I really welcome your questions. My only sadness is that we don't have more time, because I know we're going to run out of time, but I promise we'll be done by 11:30. So one thing I think is clear, that social media technologies are impacting our lives. The other thing that's clear is that it's impacting how we learn and how we practice, and we're just starting to understand the impact. Do any of you know Michael Jackson? Not personally, but you know of Michael Jackson? Interesting. A few years ago in his wrongful death case, the judge said that the doctor had abandoned his patient because during the time he was to provide care, he was texting on his telephone. Now, was that texting on Facebook? Was it texting on Twitter? Was it, like, what was that? But this is an example of a significant professional implication in this situation that it makes me pause and say, okay, how do these tools start interfacing with our professional practice? And so that's what we're going to talk about today. But my other key message, I have a couple, is that there are ways to actively, professionally participate in these tools ethically, responsibly, and there's tremendous wonderful uses. This is what we're hoping to do today. I'm hoping by the end of it you'll have greater awareness of the professional opportunities related to social media. We could spend hours on this, and I'm so thankful that Lauren is here to share some experiences of hers in that regard. We're going to examine some of the professional issues, challenges related to its use, and apply some of this understanding to your practice and your use of social media. So what better way to start than to engage in technology? So I'm going to hand it over to Mary, and let's try it. Okay, first of all, there's no wrong way to do this. If you don't have a cell phone, doesn't matter. We're just going to try using this as a bit of a poll.
I thought I was just a techie. So we have a series of questions for you to try, and I see that some people have already been very keen, and they've already answered the first question. The first one is choose your favorite Halloween candy, and you're texting your message to 37607, and then you type in your response. The registrar did not pick a toothbrush. That's
good.
Okay, so that's your warm-up. The next three...
Wow, chocolate lovers. I'm loving it.
Yeah.
So you see how the poll reads?
Most of you prefer chocolate.
Question, do you use social media in your professional life? It's very broad. Yes, no. Or maybe not sure. Interesting. Quite a few do, over half, use some form of professional social media in your professional life. 64%, 74%. Wow. Interesting. So that's the majority. Be interesting to talk about what those different tools are and how they're used. Okay, next. Have you ever received an online friend request from a client or their family member? Interesting. A considerable number of you have. I would almost one third. So that'll be interesting to understand how you dealt with that. Next one. Have you ever seen inappropriate use of social media by a colleague? And what I'm meaning is sort of unprofessional use. And not necessarily by an OT, but just someone that you're working with. Interesting. So, you know, upwards of half of you have had some experience with that. That's very interesting. That's cool. Huh? Good. Okay, just give us a bit of a flavor of what we're dealing with today. I think that's our last question. So no point in me doing all the talking. What I would like to happen now is to actually at your tables start answering a few questions and having some discussion, and then we're going to come back together. So let's spend the next 10 minutes just actually talking about what social media tools that you use in your OT practice, what are the main issues for you related to social media, and what questions do you have about social media and OT practice. One of the reasons that I think this is going to be interesting, A, we'll learn from one another because we have a number of people that are using it, and B, it'll give some guidance to the College of OTs around further work that they may want to do on this topic. So sitting at your tables, if there's only a couple of you, maybe join together, you'll see that there's sticky notes on your table. What I'd like you to do is to jot down briefly answers to these three questions. And then we're going to spend about 10 minutes talking about this at your tables and then coming back. Then we'll jump into the presentation. So what social media tools do you use in your OT practice? What are the main issues for you related to it? And what questions do you have about social media and OT practice? Okay, let's pull back together. Sounds like some interesting discussion. Let's get a flavor of some of the things that you talked about. Can anyone give me an idea of some of the different types of social media tools that you use in your practice? What are some of the things that came up at your tables? YouTube? LinkedIn? Facebook? Skype? Blogs? Wow, really a full range. Waypages? Yeah, good. Twitter? Blogging? Do people consider email to be social media? What do you think? You can use email through various different platforms, and sometimes we describe email as sort of communication technology that is sort of distinct from social media, but it's also used within some of those platforms. So I like to toss it in there, and certainly for healthcare providers, email is a huge, huge issue because increasingly clients and their families are wanting to contact us through email and vice versa, quite frankly. Tell us some of the main issues for you related to social media. Can people give me a couple of examples? Confidentiality, privacy, consent, inability to reverse or withdraw consent once it's out there. So the whole area of boundaries between personal and professional, like Facebook in particular, but lots of other ones as well, how do we manage that? Security, actual security of information, the vulnerability of the client. So just the whole issue of the actual hazards of the medium that you might not filter what you say as you would sort of when you're in face-to-face. So we have different sort of reminders when we're drifting in face-to-face things. Might be out of context, yeah. Oh, you guys are really, you're hitting on my presentation. This is fantastic. Can't stand it. Duplication, yeah. Oh, email, text, so same message. Ah, interesting. Really, clients taking therapy videos? Like of you as a therapist? Oh. I'd like to talk about that. You planted some nice seeds for the rest of the presentation. What I'd like you to do is continue to generate questions and issues and ideas, even as you sit at the table. Then what we're going to do is collect them at 11:30. We're going to post them in the lunch area and keep adding to them. And hopefully there'll be a bit of a strategy from the College of OTs to start getting some of those questions answered. And I'm certainly able to answer them as well. So let's jump into it. So I guess the big question is, what is social media? First of all, it's a term that we use to describe tools, platforms that people use to publish, to converse, to share content online. It's used to share things like opinions, information, to promote discussions, and to build relationships. It can use a variety of formats. So we've talked a little bit about text, and I don't necessarily mean text messaging. I mean the written word. Could be text messaging, could be pictures, could be videos, could be audio. YouTube, for example, could be a combination of all of those. I think what I'm learning in terms of this work is the important thing to understand is that social media does not just refer to one thing. And it's a group of ever-changing online tools that can be used in various ways. I found a really interesting thing on the internet about OTs the other day when I was looking, and it says, okay, just list, this just kind of blows my mind. A Google search for blogs and occupational therapy. How many results do you think that would find? I mean, I know it's kind of a dumb question, but 3,900,000 results. Google search, blogs, occupational therapy. I'm kind of on the low-end user. This number just, like, blows me away. Okay, another one. Twitter, okay, so it's sort of a Yellow Pages directory for Twitter, and it has more than 200 listings for occupational therapy, 220 listings. LinkedIn, which is, some of you may know, it's this sort of professionally oriented social media site, has 101 occupational therapy-related groups. That's kind of mind-boggling to me. I'd be interested to know how many Facebook friends, quotes, that some of the OT sites that you use have. Like, what is kind of the volume? When I talk to other healthcare professionals and I ask them, how would you rate your use of social media from novice, intermediate, expert? We get some that feel expert, but the large number of healthcare professionals feel that they're sort of novice, intermediate. So there's so much potential for us to learn and engage in some of these topics and some of these modalities. Some of the risks that I see when we look at the literature and look at our experiences at the college relate to a couple of things. I'll just kind of highlight them. One of the things in terms of the risks of the use of social media relates to the permanence of the information. And I'm going to be saying things that probably you know, but I think it's worth emphasizing. And the thing about the internet is that there's no delete button. The social memory of the internet is indefinite. And so that is something to be aware of in terms of when we post, when we upload, when we do things on social media, that it's generally permanent. Second thing is the extent of the privacy controls. And although sites have privacy controls, they're very complex and they're changing. And there's many ways to get around them. I don't know if people in the room consider themselves Facebook experts, but I was talking to someone who was, quote, a Facebook expert. And they said to me, Barb, do you realize that when Facebook does any sort of upgrading to their software, it resets the privacy settings? I didn't know that. I use Facebook, you know, modestly, and I don't even know exactly what that means, but what it tells me is that I have to do some housekeeping in that regard in terms of privacy settings, in terms of the social media sites that I use. What we're finding at the College of Nurses is that many nurses are not as aware of as they should be about the whole area of privacy settings, and they're kind of overly confident about some of the protections that they provide. So that's another area. And the last one relates to this idea of the scope of distribution. Because information is electronic on social media sites, it's easy to distribute, to archive, to download, to cut, to copy, to paste, to places that you have never dreamed of. So when we talk about scope of distribution in terms of a risk, what I take away from that is that we kind of lose control of the information that we put on the internet. These are cautionary notes. They're not to be discouraging. It's more, how do we build awareness as practitioners about how to use and appreciate and enjoy the benefits of these tools? So why on earth is the College of OTs and the College of Nurses and, quite frankly, all of regulatory colleges in healthcare, why are we interested in this topic? What I start with by saying is, as colleges, one of our roles is to set standards related to professional practice. And there's a number of standards related to things such as, we've already talked about it, privacy, confidentiality, professional boundaries. We could talk about marketing. All of these things are of interest to the college. and all of these things have implications for social media. When I think of the use of social media and the wonderful uses, I think of certainly the College of Registered Nurses, and I'm assuming the College of OTs, really embrace the notion of lifelong learning, continuous professional development, and social media and the internet just provide a wealth of opportunities for this. And so there's tremendous positive uses. I just want to share this Facebook page. You've probably, many of you have seen it, and it's a wonderful page by CAOT. This is an example of a professional use of social media that has tremendous opportunity to network, to share, to build professional alliances and linkages. And here's another one. This is a CRNBC is on Twitter, and we have a Twitter feed, and people can, here's one, for example, you can learn how to use social media, links it right to our social media guidelines. So lots of good uses. And what I say is that it's not the technology that is the issue. It's sometimes how we use it. And this is what we have to be clear about. What we're finding at the College of Nurses is that students and some healthcare providers, they're using social media personally, and they're not always aware of the professional implications of doing so. So that's what we're going to talk a little bit about today. And this is an example of a situation. It's a legal case out of the States, 2011, so it's very recent, of a nurse that was fired for being on Facebook while she was administering medication. And, like, what's the big deal, really? No, seriously, nurses multitask. But this situation, and I actually use this as a cautious tale. I don't want to be disrespectful, but the judge held up the discipline and the firing and said, you know what, it's dangerous. It is dangerous. It's a threat to patient safety to be on Facebook and providing care at the same time. Now, of course, if you're providing care through Facebook, that's a different story. But this is an example of where the personal use and the professional use have kind of collided. So in terms of professional issues, there's sort of four themes, and four themes are related to privacy and confidentiality, professional boundaries, the image of OTs, school and employer, and the whole area of professional marketing. Professional marketing comes into play, the requirements of that come out of the bylaws from the College of Occupational Therapists, so we're going to touch on that a little bit, even though I know that that may not fully apply to all of you. Increasingly, healthcare professionals, nurses, occupational therapists are more and more interested in private practice. So I thought it was worth touching on. So let's just go through them one at a time. And I'm hope that I can entertain questions, but I am also wanting to not be over time. So if you have questions, like I say, toss them out and let's help me. I'll be having to monitor myself. So let's just go at it. Privacy. One of the primary ethical concerns, period, forget about Facebook, forget about social media, in healthcare right today is privacy and confidentiality. This is an increasingly important ethical value. And the bar is continually being raised on this topic. And so because social networking and communication occur online, what might have been private conducted face-to-face is now public, and that can affect patient privacy and confidentiality. The question that I often get from nurses is, what if the patient doesn't respect their own privacy? So, for example, lots of your clients have blogs and all sorts of personal information on the internet and telling a story, etc. Question for you. Is it okay for you to pass that on? So it's already out there. The information is already on the internet. Is it okay if an OT passes that kind of information on? What do you think? So no? No consent. Yeah. What else? So it could carry some weight coming from a professional instead of coming from a friend? This is an actually interesting question because this comes up all the time, not only online but actually in public. So if the patient is already sharing information about them, what's the big deal if the professional carries it on? And what I say about that is that the patient doesn't have a code of ethics. So the code of ethics in terms of privacy and confidentiality is what the healthcare professional owns. I'm just going to actually take you to your code of ethics, and this is what it says. It says that occupational therapists safeguard the confidentiality of information acquired in the context of professional relationships to protect the client's rights to privacy. What does that look like in terms of protecting your client's privacy in general? Is it okay to look up your patient on the internet, your client or their family? What are the issues? Is that an invasion of privacy? I mean, it's public information. We've never had to really think about these things before because we never really had the internet. What is the implication? We're going to talk about that a little bit later. So privacy and confidentiality are a big issue, and I want to kind of explore it a little bit related to photography. Occupational therapists, we've already know, they safeguard the confidential information in the context of the professional relationship. We protect our client's right to privacy. So let's just talk a little bit about it in relation to photography. What does that mean in relation to photography? We are meant to maintain our client's privacy. What are you thinking? In terms of the use of photography, we have a responsibility to maintain our clients' privacy. How does that relate to the use of photography? Yeah, so I have to have consent to use photos or videos. Specifying what context. Yeah, what else? Someone had their hand up. Yeah, what you're going to use it for. Right, so this is the issue of not the nurse, not the OT taking the picture, but the patient is taking the picture of other clients and even the OT. Right? This is an interesting one. Depending on what device you use to take the photo, like your iPad or whatever, it could actually be lifted to various different forums or platforms and show up in places that you hadn't thought of. So a key message around the use of photography is that taking photographs of patients without their consent is an invasion of privacy. And patients and clients and to some extent their family, but for sure patients and clients need to be confident that when they come to seek care from an OT, that they're not going to be photographed unless there's a professional purpose and unless they have consent. And so there's many, many situations that we're seeing at the college in terms of lapses, say, in professionalism related to the use of photographs. So photos being uploaded on the internet, videos being uploaded on the internet, photos being exchanged through email that would be quite consistently viewed as an invasion of privacy. So privacy is very important in terms of the use of photos and videos. And so you want to, I guess my key message is you want to be thoughtful. You want to be careful, A, when is it appropriate to take photos? What are the policies of the agency that you work with or your own private practice? How are they used? How are you getting consent? And just be very thoughtful about sharing videos and photos. We never actually had this problem before because, of course, it was actually kind of curious. Everyone here had a cell phone pretty much. Like there might have been a few outliers. And all of those cell phones these days largely have cameras on them. So this is a hazard that we have to be aware of as healthcare professionals as this technology creeps into our pockets and as it creeps into our practice. So photos, key message, be thoughtful about your photo and video sharing. The other area of discussion is this whole area of professional boundaries. I was really interested last year that your topic was on that, and it really ties nicely to the topic here today. So let's just go back to the code. Code of Ethics says occupational therapists recognize the power imbalance inherent in professional therapeutic relationships and maintain professional boundaries. I don't know about you, but as a healthcare provider, this is an area that we face challenges in continually in the face-to-face world, okay? Have you had personal experiences where your professional boundaries have been challenged or you have faced challenges in that regard in terms of how to sort of maintain that line? Let's just see a show of hands. Yeah, very common. Well, I hate to tell you, but now we have another venue to experience some of those challenges, and that's the internet and social media. And the message is, just like face-to-face relationships, that we have to be clear in terms of how we communicate with clients and establish those boundaries. We now have to do that online. And because these tools, in terms of social media, are used heavily in a personal way, and they're used increasingly in a professional way, and they're used in ways sometimes for both. And so we have to be very, very aware. One of the things that I've been learning in terms of this work is that we have to be clear when we're using it for personal reasons and when we're using it for professional reasons and try and keep them separate. Okay? And it's because of this. So the million-dollar question, is it okay to accept a Facebook friend request from a client or a family member? Never? Yeah. Family advisory committees. I'm going to try. I know it's kind of hard to hear. I mean, we could go to the mic. I'm not sure how we want to proceed. But so there may be, what you're saying, a situation where, yeah, absolutely, you could have a professional Facebook profile or page that's separate. And so in that case, there could be a professional purpose. Mm-hmm. Other comments? People that have rural practice or in small communities or in communities within big communities but that are sort of distinct. How do you manage that when you do have personal relationships and you have professional relationships? It's very common, and I think that we have to think about is how do we keep those separate? What are the implications? And because we are in a position of power as healthcare professionals and clients are vulnerable, we have to be clear on our professional boundaries and be sure that our behaviors are first and foremost in their best interests. And contact with patients on the internet through Facebook has a tendency, or other social media sites, can change the nature of the relationship. Okay? And it's easy for the client or their family member to increasingly view the therapist as a friend rather than a professional. So again, the lines start to get blurred. And so my take-home message from this is to just be aware and be thoughtful and reflect on how you're using social media and how you're using it personally, how you're using it professionally. And some professionals, many nurses working in small rural places and others, are having discussions with clients in a proactive way in their first meeting around their use of social media. How they would deal with a friend request, how they communicate through social media, and they're actually having thoughtful discussion ahead of time to lay tracks with their clients around the use of social media. Has anyone done that? Some have, yeah. So increasingly this is part of our practice to think about not only professional boundaries in terms of the real world, but on the internet. And it can be confusing. The notion of a hug, a kiss, a poke on Facebook has a lot of room for misunderstanding. Okay? The third area, so we talked about privacy, we talked about confidentiality, talked a little bit about boundaries. Now we're going to talk about this whole notion of the image of the OT and your professional image, the image of the school. Are there any students here? And the image of your employer. So the same level of professionalism in your online interactions, you should use the same level as you do with your face-to-face interactions. So let's just go back to the code again. So in terms of image, occupational therapists act in the best interests of clients to maintain trust. Occupational therapists act in a manner that maintains respect for the profession and its members. Occupational therapists perform their professional duties in a manner that promotes a trusting, respectful work environment and that supports safe, competent care. So how might conduct on social media affect this? What are your experiences?
Angela.
Yeah.
I don't know if I
want to
be.
Just because.
If you do something unsavory,
yeah.
Even if it's in your private time,
yeah.
And it's on public media, that yeah. can affect the image of, you know, your profession or your employer. Like the people who were involved in the riots.
Unintended.
You know, have a,
yeah.
an effect on
yeah.
wherever they're
yeah.
associated.
Yeah, yeah. That consequence, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so not only what you do on the internet, but how it's interpreted. Yeah, for sure. So that whole notion of trust, like this is a fundamental foundational concept in an occupational therapist-client relationship. So awareness of how you behave online in terms of the implications of trust is significant. So again, starting to really think about what that behavior, what that might have in terms of your own credibility, the credibility of your school, the credibility of your employer. In the interest of care to clients, we need to be thoughtful of all of those things. There's an example that I was going to share with you, but I didn't have copyright approval yet of some healthcare providers in a hospital that were just kind of being silly, having a bit of a, what was like a mini food fight. It wasn't outrageous. It was just sort of casual craziness, which is a nice way to kind of unwind. It was in the workplace, and it was taken. Someone had a picture they put on Facebook, and it appeared on the cover of a newspaper that said 1,200 patients died in this hospital last year. Totally unintended outcome on that one. It wasn't anything outrageous that the staff were doing. It was just sort of frolicking fun. But again, it was the impact. And so when I read that headline, I think, okay, how does that affect the integrity of the professionals, B, the hospital, and the whole trust thing in terms of clients? So we never really had this exposure as healthcare professionals. So we have to always think, okay, we know we need to have fun and levity in our life. We know we need to vent. We know we need to debrief. We do all of these things. How do we do that now in a way that is appropriate within our control and not in a way that can have unintended consequences? So increasingly at Serum BC, we're seeing nurses that may be coming off a shift or at work and experiencing frustrations online, and then it just takes this big cascading effect. So again, purpose of today is to really talk about that awareness. Okay, how am I using this? What are my supports? If I did have issues in the workplace, what's the best way to deal with that and be cautious in terms of online behavior in that regard? Someone mentioned the notion of, you know, sort of the kind of cascading effect in a way. So you may make a statement, say, on your Facebook account about, you know, sort of craziness or just, you know, marginally inappropriate comment potentially about a client. And then it could kind of go down this path. We've got examples where nurses, unfortunately, might have made a bit of a off-color comment, and then someone added to it, and then it kind of goes down a racist path, and then it's like this outrageous path of totally unintended, but it's tied back to the nurse, and the nurse loses her job and gets reported to the college. Where does your private? This is an excellent question, and I get this all the time. When you're a healthcare provider, well, so did you hear the question? So when your children, in your case, teenagers go to parties and other people take pictures of them and then they come onto Facebook. And so then where's your privacy quotes? And this question we get, actually every time I do a presentation, I always get this question about what about the privacy of the healthcare provider? So have any of you had requests from your patients to be photographed and put on the internet? Yet? Some have? Okay. Have any of you become aware that you've been photographed or videotaped and then put on the internet? Yeah. This is again about internet hygiene, I call it. Being aware of your image online, having some sort of habits around reviewing it, untagging photos, being thoughtful about the photos that you put yourself. If you have personal social media relationships with the people that you work with, your colleagues, be aware of the flavor of those posts, delete things, try and manage it. Do housekeeping, is what I call it, on a regular basis in terms of what your image is on the internet and how your other people are interacting with you. Comment. Excellent comment in terms of the notion of intent, because we can have, in your case, in terms of the way that you interact with your clients, in terms of youth or children in a fun way, so that's a very sophisticated therapeutic intent that can be totally minimized in terms of just horsing around or something like that. And so, again, when you go back to some of the risks of the internet in terms of the scope of distribution and the impact, your intent can sometimes be lost. And so it doesn't, and I'm just actually citing this more as a cautionary note than anything. It's not that we must be able to build relationships with our colleagues. We must be able to have the benefits of these tools in terms of, I was talking to a nurse at St. Paul's the other day, and she said that Facebook on her unit is like the social fabric. It is the communication tool. If you're not on it, you're like completely lost in terms of the actual social infrastructure of the unit. So how do you then get into that professionally and be cautious and also help your colleagues keep on track? As professionals, we do have responsibilities in terms of intervening when we see unacceptable behavior to some extent. So how do we help our colleagues when we see drifts to kind of get back on track? So the image of the OT, the image of the school, the image of the employer, all are important in terms of that trust relationship. So food for thought. What might be private on one situation on the internet, it may not be. What might have good intentions in terms of just sort of like letting off steam or whatever on the internet may be totally misconstrued. So again, thinking about what is the context of the internet in terms of how you're communicating, how you're using it, and just be thoughtful. So, comment, yeah. This is the notion of the young people that are really expressing themselves and their development on the internet. The sadness of the case recently of the young girl that exposed herself on the internet, which is sexually curious behavior in a 12-year-old, is normal. And then you throw the internet on that and it takes this really terrible twist. One of the things is talking about it, I think getting back to my early conversation, we haven't really fully established the norms, the etiquette, the rules related to the use of this, and I don't think that we fully understood the social consequences. We're starting to see social consequences, and so I don't know what the answer is in terms of our young people. What I'm hoping is that we can start having some conversations about us as professionals in terms of what some of the behaviors that we want to see, want to model, some of the benefits that we want to achieve, and how do we strike that balance. We provide therapy, in your case therapy, in the social context, right? And so increasingly, privacy confidentiality is becoming a requirement and an expectation of healthcare providers. But on the other hand, we're in an environment where privacy and confidentiality is increasingly being diminished and dismissed by society in terms of young people. I had an interesting thing because we were talking the other day at work about nurses. Actually, nurses were talking about the use of cell phones at the bedside. And we were saying that, you know, that's kind of rude. Like there was all sorts of opinions around that from infection control to rude and to inappropriate. And there was a young person there and they said, what? Like what, it was just not even on their radar as a big deal. Like, it's just Like, it was just not on their radar. I'm not talking about a young nurse. It was actually a teenager. And so our perspectives around some of these things, we have these professional expectations, and then we have these societal expectations, and they're kind of keep shifting and changing. So keeping the topic on the radar is really, really important. Let's just go to the last one here, and that is the notion of marketing. And the notion of marketing is, well, of course, why do regulatory bodies care about marketing? But the actual idea is that regulatory bodies like the College of OTs and the College of Registered Nurses, we have a responsibility to ensure a high standard in related to professionalism and also in terms of protecting the public from what we call sort of misleading or irresponsible kind of advertising. And so COTC has bylaws related to marketing for those of you that are self-employed. If you haven't read them, they're really important to have a look at. Interestingly, there was a Supreme Court Canada decision in 1990 involving dentists. And in that court decision, they said that professional advertising is permissible when it serves a legitimate purpose of providing the public with relevant information. So that was sort of a finding of the court around professional advertising has to serve a legitimate purpose of providing the public with relevant information related to the service. So some of the bylaws of the colleges related to marketing fall out of some of these sort of thoughts. But I have a question for you. How many OTs out there use social media for marketing? Have Facebook pages or some? Yeah, a couple? Website? So what we have to do is consider the implications of those tools in relation to the marketing bylaws. So I'll give you an example. If you use photographs of models, for example, on your online site, and these models have not received your service, do you have to put a disclaimer on there to say that these people have not received my service so that you're not perceived as being inaccurate or misleading? So something to think about. So these are not actual patients. These are models. I'm not saying you do, but this just kind of raises these kind of questions. If you had a Facebook page that was for information only, but then you started to actually have clients able to put feedback on there, one of the things is that as a professional, we're not supposed to compare the quality of the services provided by other registrants or other health professions. So it would be inappropriate, for example, if I was a nurse, I had a website and I said, come to me because I'm known to be better than other nurses in this community, my foot care service. Okay, so that would be a contravention of the college bylaws at CRMBC and also these ones as well. But what if your patient does that? So what if you have a social media site that you use for your business and patients are putting on testimonials about how great you are, how lousy that guy was? Again, implications. So the marketing bylaws apply to all of you in private practice. And so how do you build your practice in terms of your advertising using social media, which is a tremendous tool, keeping some of these things in mind? What I would suggest is having, if there's questions, and I don't know if this is appropriate, but to call the College of OTs and have a discussion around the bylaws and the implications on social media. So if a doctor set up a rating service, that would be a violation. If someone else does it, then again, they don't have to adhere to these bylaws. And the thing about the marketing and all of the actual standards and codes, because it's jurisdictional, it's like province by province, and how the rules are across the border vary. So like, you know, you see on the TV certified hair specialist, physician or whatever promoting products, that wouldn't be allowed in BC because we can't use our title to actually sell products. So we get exposed to various different types of marketing strategies, advertising, and we have to say, okay, what is the BC context? What are the bylaws and rules that apply to us here in terms of our practice, and how do we sort of align ourselves? And social media has tremendous opportunities, but again, we have a framework to work within as professionals. So just to summarize then, so there's many professional issues. There's tremendous benefits. We're going to hear more about a wonderful example that Lauren's going to share with us in a case scenario as well. But just thinking in terms of some of the key areas around privacy, confidentiality, the whole area of professional boundaries, the whole notion of that whole image of the OT, your own image, the image of the profession, the school, your agency, and then any sort of specific issues related to how you market yourself if you're in OT in private practice, those seem to be the themes that keep coming up when you look at issues related to social media.
Question?
Yes. The question or the comment is, how do you deal with some of these matters when there's a disconnect between the organizations you work with from a policy point of view and the reality of these tools in your workplace? So increasingly, health authorities, for sure, are starting to develop policies around social media. and email, and the general trend is not prohibition. They realize that previously the trend has been prohibition in terms of can't use this or can't use that, but increasingly they're realizing that it is an effective tool. It's a tool that we can't stop in terms of the use, so how do we use it appropriately? So I know that Northern Health, I know that PHSA, I know BC Cancer, any of you that work with those organizations, they're starting to have things in writing. But as employees and as therapists and as professionals, we need to start asking for those. The question is, awareness on this topic is key, and how are we dealing with our developing practitioners, our students, in terms of trying to build awareness early on as they develop their professionalism, their professional habits? And definitely schools of nursing and schools of OT are very interested in this topic. They, too, are building awareness on it, and so increasingly it's part of their curriculum. I just did a presentation at UBC School of Nursing on this topic, and they're looking at what their policies are, how do they guide students. So it's everywhere. Other questions? How do we dip our toe into it? How do we start incorporating our building knowledge, building awareness of these tools in terms of our practice? You know, people are actually seeking health care now because of social media. And I don't mean using social media to get care. I mean they have problems related to social media, that they have anxiety, they have cyberbullying, they're actually now seeking care from us as a consequence of the use of these tools. So it behooves us to really start to understand how they work. So food for thought. Without further ado, I'm going to introduce Lauren Fox. Lauren is an OT from Victoria, and Lauren works in mental health. And she is going to share with you some interesting things about how you use social media tool and work through a case scenario. Over to you, Lauren.
Thank you. Happy to be here. So I'm going to be talking about a case study using a social media platform to actually deliver therapy. So a little bit different than some of the other examples we've been talking about. And this is going to bring up maybe some more exciting, interesting ideas of how you could use social media in a positive way. But I'm also going to scare you a little bit, make some bad things happen. But don't worry, they're all pretend. And everything's going to turn out fine in the end. So before I can talk about the case study, I need to talk about the social media platform that I'm using called SuperBetter, because I don't think probably very many of you have heard of it before. It's fairly new. But this is going to be a very fast, bare-bones explanation, and you may have more questions about how this works later on. I'd be happy to talk to you during the break if you're curious to learn more. The background of where SuperBetter came from. It was invented and designed by Jane McGonigal, who is a world-renowned game designer of what are called alternate reality games. And in 2009, she had a mild traumatic head injury and a concussion. And while trying to recover from that, she actually got depressed and became suicidal. And as she was thinking about how she could cope with this and get through her recovery, she thought that she needed to draw in what she knew from playing games to help her with her recovery. The things that she knew that helped people evoke positive emotions or could motivate them to tackle tough problems and overcome them. So she started thinking about herself as a hero on a journey. And her new persona was Jane the Concussion Slayer. And this isn't a real game. She was just thinking about this in her head. She invited her friends and family to play the game with her and be her allies in the game. And everything that she needed to do to get through her day-to-day life were quests that she was undertaking, and the pitfalls that she faced were bad guys that she was battling. And as she began to recover, she did a talk about her experiences and how it affected her, how it actually increased her sense of optimism, her sense of agency, and shared that out there in social media, on YouTube, I think. And she had a whole lot of responses. Lots and lots of people made their reply videos back. Not just people who were recovering from physical injuries that were going to get better, but even people who were managing chronic conditions and even people who were experiencing terminal illnesses started thinking about their experiences in terms of this game, SuperBetter. Again, not a real game, just a way of thinking. And they found it very helpful, very transformative, very empowering. So with that kind of response, she did some fundraising and she paired up with some psychologists and neurologists from Stanford and some other places and started a startup company called Super Better Labs. And their motto is to help people live epic lives using the mechanics of online video games, but taking that into real-world activities to help people build up social relationships and to tackle tough challenges and overcome them and to build a sense of purpose. So in March of this year, they launched a website called superbetter.com and also an iPhone app. Both of these are free to download and use, and so far have about 125,000 registered users. And when they first launched in March, they also had paired up with the University of Ohio to do a clinical study of using SuperBetter to treat brain injury rehab, and they're going to be done with data collection March of 2013. And this month, they've also paired up with Martin Seligman through the University of Pennsylvania's Positive Psychology Department to look at using this to treat mild depression. So still up in the air about how well it works. How do you actually play this game? I'm going to give you a very bare-bones explanation. There's a lot more to it than this, but just in the interest of time, I'm going to do a really brief explanation. And again, if you're curious, I can tell you more during the break.
I'm Jane McGonigal. I'm the inventor of SuperBetter. This game is designed to make you stronger, physically, mentally, emotionally, and socially, so you can better tackle whatever real-life personal challenges you might be facing. I know what it means to get super better, because when I was facing the toughest challenge of my life, a concussion that didn't heal properly, this game helped me find the strength that I needed to get through what seemed like an impossible time. I was in a lot of physical pain. I was more anxious and depressed than I'd been in my entire life. I had a hard time explaining to friends and family what I was going through. I didn't know if my brain would ever heal. I didn't know if my life would ever get back to normal. So I invented this game. It seems like a crazy thing to do, to make a game to get better in real life. But I used everything that I'd learned in 10 years' experience as a game designer, everything I knew about provoking positive emotion, about strengthening social connections, about building up players' abilities to tackle tougher and tougher challenges without giving up. I used all of that to turn my recovery into a game. The more I played this new game, the happier and more confident and more determined I felt. And as my brain started to heal, I started to see myself differently. I felt more capable. I felt like I survived a trip to the underworld and come back a stronger version of myself. In other words, I didn't just get better. I got super better.
So how do you go about getting super better? Well, you make an account, and you make yourself your own hero identity, create an avatar, and choose a challenge that you're struggling against and create an epic win for yourself, the ultimate goal that you're journeying towards. And every little step along the way, the small tasks that you need to do to reach that ultimate goal or get that epic win are your quests. And the pitfalls and things that get in the way, the traps that make it harder for you to get stronger or reach your epic win are the bad guys that you're battling. And any small, easy thing that you can do that will give you a burst of energy or increase your motivation or evoke any other kind of positive emotion are called power-ups. You play this in your real life. You're not doing this on the computer. So you're out completing quests, battling bad guys, activating power-ups, and then you come back to the iPhone app or the website and you just click, I did this, I completed that quest, I activated that power-up, I battle that bad guy. And that moves you through levels and gives you points and awards and things like that. And you can play this on your own in a perfectly private setting as the hero. And so it's media, but it's not social media yet. But you can also invite other people to play with you, to be your allies. And allies can see everything that you're doing. They can like whatever they see. They can comment on what you've done. They can also actually give you awards for any of the achievements that you've done along the way. They can suggest ideas to you. They can suggest quests that they think might help you get closer to your epic win. They can suggest face-to-face check-ins and meetups. And it's not like Facebook where just anybody can see that you're playing this and can attempt to ally you. Nobody can see that you're doing it. You have to actually reach out and invite people to be your ally. And at any point, you can un-ally them.
Everything in this game is designed to help you get stronger by building up your personal resilience. When you're resilient, your body is better able to withstand stress and heal itself. You have the mental focus and determination you need to be successful. You're able to activate positive emotions when you need them most, and you get strength from your friends and family. So why are we so focused on building up your personal resilience? It's all based on scientific research. Study after study shows that resilience is the single most important personal skill that you can develop if you want to be happier, healthier, and more successful in whatever you do.
So that's the bare bones explanation of Super Better. And we're going to take you on a bit of a journey, a recovery journey, using Super Better as a tool to help our client. So if you'd like to, you'll see an envelope on your table that has some written out description of the case study that we're going to do. And we're going to start out with this person and move through the journey. Along the way, some bad things are going to happen. But don't worry. It's all pretend. None of it really did happen. And there is going to be a happy ending at the end, so don't get too worried. This is our client. This is a model. I actually didn't treat her. So this is an imaginary case study. And our client is Linda. She's a 29-year-old overweight woman with chronic pain following an injury that she had 6 years ago. She also has fibromyalgia, depression, and anxiety. She's not currently suicidal at all. She has no suicidal ideation, but she did have an attempt 3 years ago where she took an overdose of Tylenol. Nowadays, she's living on PWD. She spends most of her time in her apartment, doesn't really get out very much. She does use a computer quite a bit. She interacts with friends on Facebook. She likes to play Farmville. She enjoys going on eBay and buying things through auctions. She used to like to dance before her injury. She did ballet and hip-hop and jazz. And she's been referred to a hospital-based outpatient pain clinic where you work. And she's come in to meet with you, and she is interested. She does want to manage her pain better. She'd like to be more physically active, and she'd like to be more involved socially with people face-to-face outside of her apartment. And she's interested in some of the programs you have to offer. She'd like to take the mindfulness-based pain management group and the gentle yoga group and the walking group. But after 3 weeks, she hasn't really engaged very well. She's only come twice. And when you talk to her about it on the phone, she says, the bus ride in really flares up my pain, and I can't really face that every day. And I feel quite anxious when I'm in the groups. I don't feel like I can keep up with everybody else in the walking group, and I don't really know if I can do this stuff. So at this point, you're wondering if maybe you should discharge her. But you've just heard about this thing called Super Better, and you think, I wonder if this might be a way to engage her in a treatment program. But before you do that, you might need to pause and reflect on the talk that you heard from Barb and see if there's any things you should consider ahead of time. So why don't you do that now, just very briefly, amongst yourselves and your table. Try to think of some maybe high-level concepts, ideas of things you should think about before you might plunge into this kind of therapy with this person. So let's draw our discussions to a close for a moment. Just in the interest of time, I know there's lots of good ideas going on right now. But I'm curious to hear what are some of the things that people thought of.
Hi, we thought of two different programs that the government runs right now for her because she's having trouble getting out into the community and because she's comfortable with the computer. One is Bounce Back, so you get a DVD and a person will phone you and check in with you and you set goals, and it's around depression and managing some of those, and it's free. And the other one is a 6-week chronic pain self-management course that the government is also offering. So you phone and it's online, so they meet for six weeks, I believe it is, and you set little small goals. We thought that would be a good starting point for her.
So your thinking was, don't even use Super Better at all. Use something else.
Well, to start, as a way in.
Yeah. Any other thoughts around contemplating using Super Better, what would be some things you would need to consider ahead of time?
We thought there might need to be some system change because rehab is often slower to embrace newer ways or different ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
So this people might take it wrong if they see you playing a game or interacting with a platform that looks like a game. So we need to educate, ensure we have appropriate technology to even access this through our publicly funded sites where we're working. So we thought there needed to be a lot of education.
So a lot of thinking about the environmental context, both the access and the social, cultural context.
We wondered a bit about whether it should be seen as a therapist tool or as the client's tool. Because when it's a therapist tool, we have the ability to direct it.
Mm-hmm.
And we can sort of choose the progression and choose what comes next. But with this, we might not have that same capacity to direct. So the question becomes, is it our tool or is it their tool? And are we just participating in it?
Yeah, so really looking at how do you negotiate a treatment plan in a new way where power balance might shift a little bit more towards the client. Were there any thoughts related to some of the things that were brought up in the earlier talk?
Actually, I want to say something about that Barbara talked earlier and that use of social media in a new way where actually as a therapist, become actually a player in that game, and that's what I like as a recreation therapist, and gives us another opportunity to be less threatening, but rather somebody who is ally in a game in the social media and use it appropriately instead of wondering about is it wrong to really connect in such a way. I think it's a really cool idea. And also, recreation therapy is what I like here. It brings a significant amount of challenge to help that person to the virtual reality to access a reality itself. So to use that tool, actually access the services later on.
Yeah, so it can have the potential to be much more of a collegial kind of treatment planning experience.
I've got a question about the permanence of the data once it gets out there and the client's wishes about what was shared about their illness.
Yeah.
Did that exist?
Yeah.
And the security around that.
Excellent.
Where is this warehouse, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And also logistically in certain organizations, if you were to do this on a work computer, how do you negotiate firewalls and that sort of thing?
Sure. Excellent. So looking at the client's confidentiality and privacy, and also within your workplace, what kind of problems might come into play?
We also had a question around the appropriateness when you offer this program to one of your clients, whether or not there's going to be confidentiality issues discussed beforehand in terms of you're playing this game. Maybe the game itself is secure, but would you post a comment, on Facebook, I'm doing this quest, something along those lines where the boundaries have gone beyond the game itself and are now being included in other media. Also, in terms of the appropriateness of the quests, it's a little bit to that comment that was, is it therapist-driven or is it client-driven? Whose tool is it? How much control do you have over what the quests are, whether they're going to be therapeutic, et cetera, et cetera?
Excellent. Yeah, really good questions. So a lot of these questions are drawing on, knowledge level. Whenever we're approaching new media, lots of things we just don't know. We have to find out ahead of time, how does this really work? And maybe our clients don't really know either. So rather than jumping in with both feet, we might want to do some work ahead of time to find out. So recapping some of these ideas and maybe adding a few more, we can think about the environment and the person, the occupation, and also the OT, some factors involved. Looking at the environment, wanting to look more closely at the privacy policy and what kinds of protections are on there of any content that's being put on and can you get rid of it, so forth. Also maybe looking at whether the client has access to the internet and is it affordable for them and do they have access to traditional types of services or not might play into whether you decide to use something like that. Of course, ergonomics. I mean, you're sitting down in front of a computer, so that's always going to play in. And then your own workplace policies and professional guidelines that might affect choosing to use something like this. And then looking at the occupation itself, there might be some considerations. We're talking about using a video game as therapy. Is there any potential harm to that for this particular client. You know, she's sitting down in front of the computer. It could increase her back pain. She has maybe hinted that she's using eBay a little bit more than she wants to. If she sits down in front of a computer, is that going to prompt her to continue on to do some other things online that she doesn't find too helpful in her life? And then what about the occupational performance issue that she's working towards? Is it amenable to being shaped as quests? Are the issues that she are getting in the way, could they be conceptualized as bad guys? This kind of approach is really good for developing some habituation. So is that one of the contributing factors that maybe this could be a good treatment approach to do? And then looking at the person herself, does she have the skills to use the computer and to navigate this kind of stuff? Is there some maybe motivational impairments that are a contributing factor, because this kind of approach would probably help with evoking positive emotions and increasing motivation, increasing a belief in your ability to do something? And even looking at the spiritual level, would it be helpful for her to have a new narrative of her illness experience as a heroic journey? And then looking at yourself as an occupational therapist, if you were to start using this tool, especially as an ally, how would you maintain your professional boundaries while doing that? How would you protect your client's confidentiality? What kinds of things would you need to talk to her about ahead of time in order to get a true informed consent? Do you yourself have the skills? Do you understand this platform well enough and know how to use it skillfully and effectively? And also, what kind of capacity do you have? Social media is a 24/7 real-time interaction is all it's possible. So where are the limits of how often you're going to be looking at this and what kind of duration and where are the boundaries on that? So you decide, after going through all of these factors, to go ahead and explore this with your client, and she's actually interested in it. Taking a closer look at the Super Better privacy policy, you find that it's actually incredibly robust, not like Facebook. They will never, ever sell or share your personal data. There's all sorts of fine print about the way it's encrypted and the way the measurements that are taken to secure things, how you can have your information destroyed if you need to. And that people only see what you're doing if you invite them in to play the game with you, and that you can remove them from that access whenever you want. And of course, when you're setting up the account, you can use an anonymous name and a strong password. So you go through that kind of idea, looking at the potential harms and pros and cons with Linda, and talking about what your professional boundaries will be, setting up your own account as a professional account, and that you'll be only working with her on an agreed-upon treatment plan that you've negotiated ahead of time, and that there'll be certain boundaries of time limits on that as well. So you do negotiate a treatment plan with her, and I've heard a lot of questions about the flexibility. The game does provide some pre-made quests, which all, as far as I can see, seem to be quite strongly evidence-based, but you can also completely create your own. So this scenario, we're creating our own. Linda has signed up as a dancing diva. Dancing Diva is her avatar, and she is fighting chronic pain, and her ultimate epic win is to take a dance class that she actually hasn't done in 6 years. The quests that she has created with you will be to get outside and take a 10-minute walk once a day, to practice mindfulness 5 minutes a day, to pick up a phone and call a friend and suggest a face-to-face get-together once a week, and to practice the gentle yoga 10 minutes a day. And the bad guys that she has identified together with you are the anxiety vampire. That's anytime she avoids doing something because she's feeling anxious or is afraid her pain will get worse if she does it. And she battles that by going ahead and doing it, even though she feels anxious. And the other bad guy is solitary confinement. That's staying in her apartment all day without ever getting out. She battles that by going ahead and getting out at least once a day. And her power-up is to turn on some music and move, even for a minute. So you agree to monitor after a week to see how things are going, and things are going pretty well. She is completing her quests regularly. She's battling her bad guys regularly. She's activating power-ups, and she says, you know, to log into the game environment and report these things is taking less than 20 minutes a day. It's not increasing her back pain to do that. And she's finding that she's so much more engaged in real-world activities that she's doing less of the other stuff on the computer that she didn't like so much. And she's feeling a lot more motivation and a lot more confidence. So you post on her activity wall a suggestion for an appointment, at which point you might level up these quests and increase them a bit more if she's able to. Again, after 1 month, things are also going really well. She's practicing mindfulness regularly and finding it's helping her manage her pain. She's doing yoga most days and find that as also helpful. She's getting outside every day for a 20-minute walk, and she's meeting up with a friend once a week to walk together with a friend for 30 minutes. And she's met up in person with a few other friends, and they all share an interest in knitting, and they're thinking maybe they'll have a regular thing where they get together at the coffee shop and have a knitting circle. And she's also stopped by the rec center and picked up one of the activity guides, and she's been flipping through looking at some of the dance classes. She's feeling so much more confident in her abilities that she's asked to rejoin the walking group through the pain clinic. And after she attends her first session, you award her a bravery badge to mark that amazing milestone. So things have gone really well so far. And now, just as a thought experiment, I'm going to make everything go really bad. But like I said before, it's all pretend. It didn't really happen, and it'll be a happy ending. So don't worry too much. She's so excited by using Super Better. She's finding it so life-enhancing and helpful that she invites her mother and one of her friends to come join her in the game and be an ally with her. And that's when you realize that now that they can also see everything you've posted, including the bravery badge for coming to the pain clinic walking group and that appointment time that you suggested on her wall. You've also been very inspired by her progress, and you think, you know, you've been playing this as an ally, but maybe you want to be a little bit more and you wouldn't mind playing it for yourself as a hero. And it seems to be okay because nobody can see what you're doing inside of your own game world. You haven't invited anybody to see. You can play as a hero and be fairly private about it. And you decide to start getting back into your workouts, and maybe you can run a 10K race. That would be your epic win. And as you're doing this, completing some quests and things like that, you poke around and notice that there is a forum. And you click through to explore and find out that the forum is open to everybody in the Super Better community, anybody who's a registered user, as a place to interact with other players and maybe find some allies or just get advice on how to play the game. And because security is pretty tight at Super Better, you have to make another account to join the forum. But you're maybe a little lazy and you just use the exact same name that you used with Linda. So you're still identifying yourself as Super Sidekick as you were with Linda. And you start poking around the forums and seeing other people who are trying to get fit, and some of them are also battling addictions. And you end up, as reading through the threads there, writing a few posts about how, you know, when you go out on Saturday night and maybe have a little too much to drink, it's hard to get up in the morning and do your Sunday run. Maybe all that drinking should be a bad guy. You should start paddling. You keep poking around, and you find that there's a pain management forum as well, and you think you'll look in there and see if there's anything helpful for any of your clients. And while you're looking around, lo and behold, you find that Linda, under her Dancing Diva name, has also been exploring the forums and posting, and she has a few comments on a thread about body image and chronic pain and the effects that has on mood. And in reply to another user, in trying to be, sounds empathetic, she says, you know, I really know what you mean. It can be so hard that I sometimes wonder if I really want to be alive. So at this point, you're kind of panicking. What are you going to do? You keep reading. Things get a little bit worse because there's a troll on there who says something fairly cruel and obscene, egging her on to go ahead and commit suicide. And I don't think this would really happen in the Super Better community. It's a very supportive place, but it does happen. There are people out there who get their kicks from just stirring up trouble. And even, you know, we mentioned Amanda Todd earlier today, even on her memorial Facebook page, after she so tragically already died, there are still people posting horrific things on that Facebook page. So it does happen. Something to maybe have thought ahead about and know about. So now that I've made everything go really bad, take a few moments to reflect back on that scenario and see what are some of the problems that happened, if you can identify what they are, and maybe even what could you have done to have prevented it or at the very least have been more prepared for it. I thought we could start by seeing if we can identify the main headings of the main issues that happened and then discuss what we could have done to prevent it and or what we could do to have been more prepared. Anybody have any ideas of some of the main headings of the main issues that happened? Confidentiality breach, yes. So when the therapist posted the name of the pain clinic and the time of the appointment, thinking this is a private environment, it's just me and the client, but then later on it wasn't anymore. Yeah, excellent. Any other main headings of main issues that happened? Yeah, over here. The program doesn't have any likes, but that's an option. You can invite anybody you want to be your ally, and that wasn't discussed ahead of time as, you know, I guess the therapist assumed she would be the only ally. and didn't think through. So in a sense, you might call that maybe an informed consent issue where the person has invited their family to join the therapeutic interaction, but there wasn't any discussion about that ahead of time. What else? Yeah, so professional boundaries and professional image. Going out there as her own hero journey, but putting that into the public forum and then talking about some, what was it, unsavory behavior in the public forum. What else? Okay, so you're touching back on back to that idea of this occupation as therapy. Is there any inherent harm in using a game like this? And so the question is this actually evoking positive emotions and true motivation, or is the person in fact gaming the game and lying about it and feeling bad that they might fail? So that's a really good point. Right. So I'm not sure if I heard everything you said, but it seemed that, you know, maybe there were some underlying issues around body image that never really came out in the initial assessment. The therapist didn't really have a radar up about that, maybe, and that this tool might, you know, it's not going to be, it's like when you see you have a hammer and you think everything's a nail, you might fall into that trap if you have some new shiny tool like this and neglect other things. So there's this duty to provide care if you discover that somebody is suicidal and it's an unusual way to discover it, but then what do you do about that in crisis management and so forth? And any other last main issues discovered? I think with some of these new technologies, you might think that you understand it, and then you find there's all these other little parts to it that you didn't realize. And so how do you know if you really are competent and skilled and that? So there was obviously several things the therapist hadn't really thought about, like the existence of the public forum and how that might interact. And, of course, within a public forum, there's the opportunity for cyberbullying, trolling to happen. So how could we have prevented some of these things from happening, or what could we have done to be more prepared? Any ideas about that? Just making an account and playing it all out as much as you can in every different scenario. And actually, I haven't done this with a client yet, and I've made 3 fake accounts so that I can see how they all interact and, like, what would happen if I posted as an ally. Can the other ally see that? And all these kinds of questions so you can figure out how it all works. What else? I think we touched on the idea of talking ahead of time about, well, you have the potential to invite other allies in. If you do that, then that is essentially bringing your mother to the therapy session. And, you know, that's an option, but we need to talk about it ahead of time and have that informed consent in place. Yeah, so having a clear idea of what your treatment plan is and what the goal is that you're working towards, and that this tool is just one piece of the bigger picture. It's a really good point that when you're setting it up ahead of time, defining how often are you going to be interacting, for how long, and at the end that you're going to be unallied and no longer part of the game environment. So let's see if we can get our clean up this mess that we made and get our client to a good ending. So obviously in this scenario that I just gave you, we have some triage to do, where there's an apparent suicidal ideation going on. So the therapist actually goes back to the office and picks up the phone and calls the client, does a suicide risk assessment on the phone, and finds out that she's actually not suicidal right now at all. She was just being empathetic and reflecting back to a time in her life when she was. And although it was upsetting to read what the troll had written, she was just a little bit angry and wasn't traumatized by it. And she went ahead and reported, flagged that post, and it was removed by the moderators, and according to the policy, the person's account would be blocked. And you go ahead and work through a crisis plan with her anyway, so that she has in place some ideas of if she were to start to feel suicidal, you know, need crisis plan and other resources she could draw on and things she would do. And you make a follow-up appointment with her to look through some ways she can protect her privacy and confidentiality if she is going to be using the public forums, maybe using a different username, for example, and being aware that anything that's posted in the public forum is open to the world because anybody can copy it and send it anywhere, so not putting any personal information in there at all. So that was the immediate triage stuff. There's also the breach of confidentiality, which you would need to report and contain and remove and go through all the protocols of your organization to do that. And, of course, change your practice about, as we already discussed, about the idea that new allies could be invited in, and that would be part of the informed consent process, and that you would no longer post anything in the game environment that has any identifying information in it. And finally, the professional boundary issue. You'd go back to the forum and delete your posts and make a separate personal account that you keep entirely separate from what you're doing professionally. So after 8 weeks, Linda has gone ahead and signed up for a dance class, and she's using all her pain management techniques, and she's socially active and physically active. And she's decided that she wants to keep using this game in her own life with her own allies. She started a new epic win to get a part-time job. So in your discharge meeting, you have her un-ally you, and you offer her a referral to a job coach. And as part of the discharge summary, with her permission, you explain how Super Better was part of her recovery journey and still is. And it had a happy ending. Yay. And I'm right on time. So thanks, everybody.
There. So as a member of the board of the College of Occupational Therapists, we just want to take a moment to thank both Barb and Lauren. It's been a great session, and I think that we can all agree that it's given us a lot to think about. We would like to present each of you with a small token of our appreciation for coming here today, spending some time with us, sharing your experiences and your knowledge. So please, all of us, let's join together to thank them. So for Barb, thanks so much. And Lauren, thank you.